dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas, and Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. One of the people I've come to admire greatly in that fight for the free world, and a man who certainly understands the battle space we're in as well as anybody, is our guest for this entire hour. He is John Guandolo. John has had a distinguished record of service to our country in uniform as a United States Marine, as a member of the FBI's SWAT team, ultimately its commanding officer, also as an FBI special agent responsible for counterterrorism. We're going to talk with John about insights that he's gleaned from all of these fields of activity and experiences, and about his new book, Raising a Jihadi Generation: Understanding the Muslim Brotherhood Movement in America. John Guandolo, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. It's great to be back with you.
Let's talk a little bit about your background, John, by virtue of the many, many experiences that you've had, and in particular, how they sort of came together in terms of understanding the nature of the enemy we're confronting, and the challenges you found in talking about that inside the United States government these days?
That's a great question, and that certainly opens up a lot of stories and the journey that I took inside and outside the government. Well, I can say that after 9/11, certainly there was I've written about this and shared about this before, but the vast array of emotions that you deal with when you're either in the FBI or in some position to respond or deal with what happened on 9/11, and I primarily was focused with what was going on at the Pentagon, and being obviously the center of our, you know, logistics and command structure for the Department of Defense, and having been an active duty Marine officer, there were a lot of emotions swirling around about that, and so the question of what happened and who did this, those were the questions of the day. And at the time, I was still on a unit that was working a variety of things, but not in counterterrorism. But there was an opportunity. The office created two new squads, two new units to deal with this issue. And I was asked if I would like to join one of them. And of course, I did. And it was a very aggressive squad made up of criminal agents, some guys with counterintelligence experience, financial, the whole nine yards. And as we dug into this, several major investigations came to light. And one of them was the investigation of Army captain who had been numerous times down to Guantanamo Bay and was the ringleader of an organization with other Muslims to subvert the mission down there. And it was really an espionage case, and it's the case of James Yee,
who was, as I recall, John, a chaplain in the United States Army. Is that right?
That's right. He was a West Point graduate who left the Army, then went to Al-Noor Institute in Syria after converting to Islam, became an imam, and came back into the U.S. military as a Muslim chaplain. And as you know, the Muslim chaplain program was founded by Abdurrahman al-Amoudi, an al-Qaeda financier who's now in prison. And as a sidebar, the certification now for the Muslim chaplain program is done by the Muslim Brotherhood still. But that I didn't know any of that at that time. And what happened was, as I started investigating Captain Yee and looking into how did a guy like this get certified, I looked at the certifying authorities inside for DOD, the agencies. And as I started to unravel that, I started to identify and unravel the broader network inside the United States, the Islamic network here, the jihadi network.
Yeah. And John, I want to drill down on several of those different pieces, but just staying sort of with your personal history and background. You had served in combat in Operation Desert Storm. You had come back from that, joined the FBI initially in the SWAT forces, as I've mentioned. Your combat training obviously equipped you to have an appreciation of the importance of intelligence and the need to understand the enemy we're confronting. Yet what I think you've just described was one of the early indicators that we don't have a clue as to the nature of the enemy that we're confronting, even now, 12 years or so after 9/11. And again, we're going to develop this more fully, but just staying with this basic story of how you sort of got into this counterterrorism struggle to understand who was constituting the terrorist threat. Give us a sense of the sort of environment. Were people that you were dealing with in the Pentagon, in the FBI at the time, troubled at all that a guy who was, shall we say, colorful, Abdurrahman al-Abudi, had been, you know, busted by at that point, but nonetheless was clearly a guy who had, if you did any due diligence on him at all, very troubling connections to Islamist causes and, as you say, even al-Qaeda. What was going on that caused a fellow like this to be selected to recruit and train and credential chaplains for the United States military?
You know, that's the million-dollar question. I will say, when you ask what was going on the inside, what was astounding to me, because my military training, both in the infantry as an infantry platoon commander in Desert Storm, and then later as a reconnaissance officer, and doing very different level stuff inside the military, is yes, you always got to know your enemy, but you got to respect your enemy, and I think as warriors, one of the things I learned is there's an attitude coming, especially with this enemy, that you got to deal with. And any sign of weakness perceived by them on our part, in other words, any weakness they sense that we have, they have no sense of sympathy or mercy. They do not. I've never seen that. I don't know anybody in the military that's experienced that with this enemy. And so any sense of weakness is they will pounce on, and it emboldens them.
Yeah. And John, so let me just drill down on that particular point, because that seems to me critical. In your experience, when you indicate what they perceive as weakness, is it not the case that that's regarded as submission? And what is the response on the part of this enemy doctrinally to such evidence?
They'll steamroll you. They will absolutely steamroll you, and they will know that they have you. And as you well know, what this leads to and what we can get into is this leads to their ability to really operate within our system, because they believe our leaders, and I believe they're right, they believe our leaders are not men of strength and iron will. They're men who are more interested in appeasing and making nice with these guys, thinking that somehow speaking nice to them and showing how much we respect them is going to be honored by them. It's not. They see it as weakness, and they just see it as a way to another reason to put their foot on us.
Yeah. We're speaking with John Guandolo. He's the author most recently of Raising a Jihadi Generation, Understanding the Muslim Brotherhood Movement in America. He also is a contributing author to the book of the Center for Security Policy entitled Sharia, the Threat to America. And we're going to talk about this doctrine of the Muslim Brotherhood. But John, just to follow the story of John Yee, what came of your efforts to investigate what John Yee was up to and why?
Yeah, Captain Yi, first of all, the entire case was more an espionage and counterintelligence case. It wasn't a terrorism case although it had aspects of that. What they were doing is he had a number of men, Muslims, both uniformed, including an Air Force officer, but other uniformed translators and linguists, as well as contract translators and linguists, who were collecting information and providing information to prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. And he was, you know,
John, hold the thought. We're going to come right back with more with John Guandolo about John Yee and much more straight ahead.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
On August 2, 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
Debbie Lee became a Gold Star mom that day.
And it started a lifelong mission of her own. In Mark's honor, Debbie founded America's Mighty Warriors.
Dedicated to supporting the troops and their family.
AMW educates the public through speaking engagements, rallies, and events to raise awareness and appreciation of our military.
AMW advocates for the troops.
Funding, rules of engagement, benefits. AMW is committed to being a voice for justice for our troops. AMW serves Gold Star families, retreats, concerts, special events.
Good things to remind the families they're not forgotten.
America's Mighty Warriors.
Nonprofit.
Dedicated to the troops and their families.
Donations are tax deductible.
Log on to americasmightywarriors.org.
Find out how you can help.
The best of America deserves our best. Log on today.
americasmightywarriors.org.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.americanfreedomlawcenter.org.
If you don't know where Bill Bennett stands, here are some of his beliefs.
I believe Americans should largely do much more for themselves than many Americans are doing.
But do I rule out government as something that might be able to assist in that? And that I do not.
I do think families, churches, and schools are better places for that to happen. People should do for themselves what they can. Government should do what people cannot do for themselves.
Get to know Bill Bennett, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're visiting with John Guandolo, combat Marine, FBI agent with responsibility both for SWAT operations and counterterrorism investigations. He has recently published a new book, Raising a Jihadi Generation, Understanding the Muslim Brotherhood Movement in America. And we're talking with him about sort of insights into the challenges that we're facing in understanding the enemy, notably the postmortem on Benghazi. And John, before the pause there, you were talking a bit about how the evidence on the ground makes clear we're dealing with people who are not on our side, who are jihadis, and there is no distinction to be made between so-called good jihadis and bad ones.
That's correct, and that is what the New York Times is essentially claiming, that because we, you know, the people that participated, the jihadis that participated in the Benghazi attack, were not card-carrying members of Al-Qaeda, that somehow that shows that this wasn't what the people who understand what happened in Benghazi says it was. That's not a sane response or analysis of this incident. You've got jihadis who understand exactly what the objective is, who understand that America is their enemy and is attacking based on the same doctrinal lines as Al-Qaeda. And so when you understand, just like when we talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, what is their objective? To impose Sharia on the world and reestablish the global Islamic State, the caliphate. What are the stated objectives of Al-Qaeda? To impose Islamic law on the world and under the global Islamic State, the caliphate. What did the Muslim in Wichita, Kansas, say he was doing, trying to blow up an airplane full of passengers? Why did he do it? Because Sharia demands it. Why did Faisal Shahzad try to blow up a vehicle in Times Square? Because he said the Sharia demands it. Why did Najee Bouazizi try to launch light off 12 suicide bombs in New York City a few years ago? Because the Sharia demanded it. Why did the 9/11 hijackers do it? Because the Sharia demanded it. It doesn't matter that you are or are not a card-carrying member, or you've sworn an oath to Osama bin Laden or Ayman al-Zawahiri or al-Qaeda. That's not the point. The point is these are jihadis, and the jihadis only have one objective.
And that is our destruction and forced submission to Sharia and furtherance of this idea of a global caliphate. John Guandolo, talk about the Muslim Brotherhood a bit more here. You've described its doctrine as being indistinguishable from that of Al-Qaeda and these other jihadis. What is its role in stimulating this jihadist ambition, among others, in the minds and hearts of Osama bin Laden and his friends, but many others besides? In other words, we're told that the Muslim Brotherhood are folks we can do business with because they're nonviolent. How does that square with what you've just described and your experience?
Well, I think anybody that comes to that conclusion, they either do not have the capability to process factual information in their brain, or they are delusional. I think it comes down to one of those, or they're not being truthful about the threat. I guess that's the other option. The Muslim Brotherhood's bylaws, the Muslim Brotherhood's, their stated objectives, their written strategies, both what we found here in the United States and documents that have been discovered overseas, all say that they exist to reestablish the global Islamic State. They were created right after the global Islamic State, the Ottoman Empire, was dissolved by Kemal Ataturk in Turkey back in the early 20s. They were created specifically because of that, to reestablish the caliphate and impose Sharia on the world. That's what their bylaws say, and they say they will do it through all means available, including violence, including fighting the tyrants and the enemies of Allah, and that's a quote. So that is who they are. That we know from their strategy that when they came to America, and this is key, when they came to the United States, they came here with a plan, not just, hey, we're going to kind of come here. They had a plan to create a framework so that when Muslims did come to the United States, because back in the early 60s, there were not very many Muslims here in the United States, and when Muslims did start emigrating to the United States, they had a plan on how they were going to educate Kate and bring them into the fold of understanding what the proper role is of the Muslim in the Muslim society that they were trying to build here. Now, on the global stage, the Muslim Brotherhood is the foundation for the global jihad. They're the foundation upon which Al-Qaeda was launched. They're the foundation upon which Hamas and thousands of other jihadi organizations have been launched around the world.
And it has, in fact, been a catalyst, as I understand it, John Guandolo, for both the violent kind of jihad and, where violence is not practicable, a stealthy form of jihad, a so-called civilization jihad. Talk a little bit about the manual, the playbook, the strategic plan that fell into the hands of your colleagues in the FBI that laid bare what this agenda entails inside the United States, whether it's being pursued by what I think of as pre-violent means or the more violent kind.
Well, that's a great question, and I think the first we need to understand, when we're talking about the Muslim Brotherhood and we're talking about jihad, jihad is defined in Islamic law as warfare against non-Muslims. And I say that because it's not, when we talk about these different forms of jihad, that is correct, because jihad is, it is propaganda, it's influence operations, it is subversion, it's psychological warfare, it's warfare through all kinds of means, including warfare on the battlefield. And that's something that a lot of folks don't understand. They believe it's something that just requires, you know, we're just talking about blowing things up and shooting people. So to your point, you've got that. You've got the acts of jihad that we've witnessed, both warfare, like full-on battles that we see on the battlefield. We see it in communities, like just recently over the weekend, the two attacks in Russia, where you have a whole brigade of female suicide bombers, which are actually not suicide bombers. Those are jihadis. Those are martyrdom operations. And again, understanding it and understanding the language we need to use. And all the way to Boston bombing and 9/11 and everything in between. But the focal point of what they're doing globally is the what you just described as stealth jihad, which is coming into it, and this is in their strategic memorandum that you just mentioned, which is to come into a society to build Islamic schools, mosques, shelters, clinics, all kinds of social organizations, in order to insinuate themselves into the society and begin influencing the society to give them the space to operate. And they use the violent jihad within the society to be able to actually point to those jihadis and say, see, this is happening because you're not giving us what we want. We're trying to help you. And so they use themselves. They pit themselves against each other. It's an act. It's a facade. And they get our leaders to capitulate. It's an amazing operation, but they're doing it successfully in Europe and in the United States.
Yeah, increasingly so here as well. John Guandolo is our guest. He is the author of Raising a Jihadi Generation, Understanding the Muslim Brotherhood Movement in America. This is, by the way, folks, a handbook for law enforcement, intelligence, and military professionals. You can get it at Amazon. It's a short but very, very informative read. I very strongly recommend it, and I'm delighted that we have John Guandolo with us for two more segments to talk about some of its insights into what not only our law enforcement and other security professionals need to know, but what we need to know as well about the Muslim Brotherhood, its civilization jihad, and its purpose of destroying Western civilization from within by our hands. More on that right ahead.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Vice President Joe Biden reportedly urged restraint during his meetings with Chinese leaders this week. It's a safe bet that, as predicted, his hosts interpreted this weak U.S. response as acquiescence to their latest and dangerous assertion of sovereignty in the East China Sea. The danger will grow if the practical effect of the vice president's diplomatic foray will be to embolden the Chinese to use their newly declared air defense zone to block critical American intelligence collection flights. It must be asked, did Mr. Biden also lowball the U.S. response to China's boasts of its readiness to kill millions of Americans with nuclear missile strikes on our country, to exercise control of outer space, and to put offensive missiles on the moon? We can't afford to greenlight such behavior. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
We're back. Our guest again is a longtime member of the national security community of the United States, a combat Marine from Desert Storm and a professional in the FBI, including as a special agent on counterterrorism matters, John Guandolo. He is an author, contributed to Sharia, the Threat to America, and also Raising a Jihadi Generation, a handbook for law enforcement, intelligence, and military professionals. And John, I want to drill down now with you on the Muslim Brotherhood right here in the United States. You were talking a bit about how it has been subverting our government. Let's talk first about what its infrastructure has been as you've uncovered it. over the decades, I guess going back to 1963 with the founding of the first Brotherhood Front, the Muslim Students Association. Talk a little bit about how that has progressed and what kind of capabilities it represents.
Okay, several points here. First of all, for your audience, quick 10-second background. In 2004, subsequent to stopping and arresting a guy in Maryland, the FBI's Washington field office raided a home of a senior Hamas and Muslim Brotherhood operative in Annandale, Virginia. And his home was raided, and in the home, the archives of the Muslim Brotherhood in North America were discovered. Numerous documents, financial records, lists of organizations, leadership, strategic documents, the strategic plan, how that plan was going to be played out. Again, photographs, videos, audio, all that stuff. A lot of that was entered into evidence in the United States versus Holy Land Foundation trial, the largest terrorism financing and Hamas trial ever successfully prosecuted in United States history. And what came, like, what were the implications of that information with regard to the infrastructure of the Brotherhood? Well, number one, the evidence demonstrated that there is something called the Islamic movement in the United States, that it is, in fact, led by the Muslim Brotherhood. And the evidence demonstrated that the largest and most prominent Islamic organizations in America were created by the Brotherhood to serve their ultimate objective, which is imposing Islamic law. And the vehicle to do that is jihad. It made clear that Hamas, a designated foreign terrorist organization by the U.S. government, is the Muslim Brotherhood in Palestine. It was created by the Muslim Brotherhood. And it lays out the leadership and how they're organized, and that the biggest organizations in North America, like the Islamic Society of North America, are actually financial support arms for Hamas. And the evidence made that very clear. We know that in the 50s, when Nasser in Egypt put the hammer down on the Brotherhood, they fled to Europe and the United States. They came here with a plan. They literally, and I'd like to just speak a moment about this, in small groups of men, 5 to 6 or 8 men, set up little nodes across the United States, first in Illinois, Indiana, and Michigan, and then by the late 70s, early 80s, all across the United States, in all 50 states, coast to coast. And these nodes were about 150 or 200 miles apart, from which they developed the infrastructure. And we have all this information. And then they started building organizations to support their actual mission here. In 1963, the very first national Islamic organization, the Muslim Student Association, created by the Muslim Brotherhood. At the time it was indicted, the Holy Land Foundation was the largest Islamic charity in America, and it was a Hamas organization. Now, those are two data points, but they're big data points. From 1963 forward, we see that all of the Islamic organizations, national organizations created, are created by the Muslim Brotherhood through the early 80s, culminating in the creation of the Islamic Society of North America, which they described, the Brotherhood's documents described the Islamic Society of North America, ISNA, as the nucleus of the Islamic movement here.
And this is a critical point, John, because one of the people that we have seen much in evidence, particularly during the Obama years, is the president of this Islamic Society of North America, Mohammed Majid. He has been given advisory roles in the Department of Homeland Security and, for that matter, in the White House. He is much in evidence in the various Eid celebrations and other Muslim-oriented outreach activities. He's even had a role in shaping the guidelines for how the United States government deals with the threats of Islamists or other violent extremists, as they're called, inside our country. Talk, if you would, John, about Mohammed Majid of this organization, the largest Muslim Brotherhood front in the United States, as you've described it, that is sort of symptomatic of a penetration of our government by the Brotherhood, not just our country.
He's a great example, Frank. I'm glad you brought him up. Let's just run through. Mohammad Majid is the president of ISNA. Prior to that, he was the vice president of ISNA for a number of years. He's the son of a mufti in Sudan, very well entrenched and in the global Muslim Brotherhood movement. So ISNA, the documents that specifically were entered into evidence that brought him, brought ISNA to be an unindicted co-conspirator, but I believe are more important are the actual documents where monies directly from ISNA's account go to known Hamas leaders and organizations overseas. And the judge in the case said that there's ample evidence that ISNA is a support entity for Hamas, which is why they're listed as an unindicted co-conspirator.
This is in the Holy Land Foundation case, Judge Solis.
That's right. Mohammad Majid, just let's run through it in 15 seconds. He advises national security staffs at the White House. He and his two senior directors work with the Secretary of State and his officers and worked with Secretary Clinton. ISNA was thanked by Senator Richard Durbin as being one of their leading organizations to advise them prior to his hearings on the civil rights of Muslims in the United States. He sits on the Homeland Security Advisory Committee. He's been given awards by the FBI, and he's moderated panels at CIA headquarters in Langley. I mean, this is the kind of access, and most importantly, as you mentioned, is in those advisory roles, he has actually shaped U.S. policy, not only direct domestic how we handle terrorism issues here in the United States, but foreign policy issues that the State Department is dealing with, including these issues like Benghazi. So it's no wonder that there's so much, I would call it, I put quote confusion in quotation marks, but so much of a lack of understanding. He's an example of the very people our leaders are leaning on to understand the threat.
John Guandolo, again, is our guest, FBI agent in the past, now doing very important work in the private sector, training law enforcement professionals, intelligence, and others in the military, for example, who have to deal with these enemies and helping them understand the threat. In fact, understandingthethreat.com is his web resource. I commend it to you, as well as his new book, Raising a Jihadi Generation. And John, talk, if you would, about the condition of the military, the professionals in the intelligence community, the law enforcement agencies, as they look at this threat. You described this earlier. Is there sort of a willful blindness going on now, or have we been blinded by folks like Mohammad Majid inside the wire?
Well, I think the leadership blinded. And let me just say, to finish up the question you asked before about the infrastructure, just in a few seconds, after the Muslim Student Association was created in 1963 and these organizations were created, we now have over 600 Muslim Student Associations at every major university and college campus in America. There are over 2,100 Islamic centers in the United States, most of which are controlled by the Muslim Brotherhood, and their strategic document says that those are the launch points for jihad. We have hundreds of Islamic societies. We have over 100 Islamic associations, which are Hamas entities. So you see that the infrastructure here is huge, and I'm just touching on a few of them.
We're going to have to pause, John, for just a moment. When we come back, I want to come back to this question, though. Given the magnitude of the threat, how is it that we are so blinded and so risk of this stealth jihad? That and more with John Guandolo right after this.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
There's a reason Bill Bennett doesn't go after people that disagree with him.
I don't think you persuade people when you yell at them,
when you make fun of them,
when you wave your finger and scold them. I don't think you turn anybody around. And I think the reason that you try to adopt the Socratic maxims of
candor, intelligence, and goodwill
is because people can change their minds.
They're not going to change their minds if you call them idiots.
I just don't think so.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice. Intelligent talk.
This is Frank Gaffney. Something is seriously wrong when the FBI interviews a jihadist like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, the older of the two Chechens believed to have perpetrated the bombing of the Boston Marathon, and sees no evil. Yet, that is the predictable result of the shackling of the Bureau that has taken place in recent years. For example, in 2011, the Obama administration actually purged FBI training materials of information that warns of the connection between the Tsarnaev's kind of religious fervor and terrifying acts of jihad. And Team Obama has also effectively told the Bureau it must get the approval of Muslim Brotherhood operatives before it can do any such training in the future. This is a formula for much more jihad in America. It's time to free the FBI so that they can do their job and protect our country. If you agree, go to www.freethefbi.com. That's www.freethefbi.com.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events to let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined for a final segment in a very special program by the author of Raising a Jihadi Generation, Understanding the Muslim Brotherhood Movement in America, a handbook for law enforcement, intelligence, and military professionals by its author, John Guandolo. And John, before the break, we were talking a bit about both the infrastructure that the Muslim Brotherhood and its affiliates have put into place throughout this country in a very systematic, disciplined way. We know that from some of their own internal memoranda and doctrinal writings. Yet it appears that despite your best efforts, there is a lack of understanding, to say the least, on the part of those responsible for protecting us against this sort of internal threat, about its nature, about even who is perpetrating it, let alone their purposes. How can this be, given that we had this windfall of a treasure trove of their documents, their playbook, come into our possession, and what's at work there?
Well, I think that's a huge question with regard to why the leadership is doing what they're doing. And I think there are many reasons. But to to get to your question about what's the status on the inside, I do have that story at the beginning of the book that I was encouraged to put in because I kept going around the country and telling the story. And when I talk about the, you know, before the book was published, people said, you know, you got to include it. And the quick version of the story is this. A couple years ago, I did a three-day program at Headquarters Marine Corps in Arlington, Virginia, on, you know, 3 days on the Brotherhood, on Sharia, and on the response at the law enforcement military level.
Right. I was there for part of it. It was very impressive.
Yeah, that's right. And on the third day, a gentleman stood up and he said, John, I am a supervisor at FBI headquarters in the counterterrorism division, been in the FBI over 14 years, and I've never heard any of this information that you guys have put out in the last 3 days. And he said, he expressed in a very colorful way how angry he was. And so I asked the whole crowd, which included about 115 FBI, CIA, DHS, military, local and state law enforcement from around the D.C., Virginia, Maryland area, including the FBI's National Joint Terrorism Task Force. And I said, how many of you knew this information before you walked in here a couple days ago? And no hands went up. Now, that is a data point that I think is critical to understand. The very people at the local, state, and federal level who are charged with protecting us as citizens do not know the very information that's required of them to actually do their job.
Yeah. And again, the kind of information that providentially came into our hands from the Muslim Brotherhood's own archives. This is unbelievable. And John, as you've gone around the country and you've conducted, subsequent to that meeting and before it for that matter, training, what kind of response are you getting from the law enforcement community and these others in this responsible business of protecting us? Are they willing to take this information aboard? Are they able to take it aboard, given the kind of direction and guidance that they're getting from their seniors?
Yeah, that's another power pack question. The first reaction I get from most of them is anger because they are very torqued that they are not being given this in the kind of detail. And once they understand that it's, as you said, it's evidentiary. This is not my opinion of what's going on. This is a factual understanding of what's going on. They get angry, and then their question by the end of a 2 or 3 day program becomes now, how do we as local and state officials deal with this? And so they're starting to. And it really is a combination of governors working with state legislators, local town councils, state and local police to go after these individuals in their locales. And we've seen it effectively working in places like Indiana, Oklahoma, Kansas, and now in other places, some a little bit in Louisiana, but not as much, but definitely starting to work. The problem is leadership, and I'm not necessarily saying in law enforcement, although that can be a problem. It's mostly in the political leadership, even the local and state elected officials in some states who are unwilling to name the threat and go after it because they don't want to get called names or be painted as some sort of in any kind of negative way. But at the local level, the average cop gets this in the first 30 minutes when they see it.
It's just common sense in the final analysis. And John Guandolo, you've helpfully assimilated much of this information and made it accessible not just to the law enforcement, intelligence, and military communities, but to the rest of us in your new book, Raising a Jihadi Generation. In the back of it, you talk, and I just want to close this out with some specifics, if you would, on how to respond to this threat, how both those responsible for our security should be responding to it, and how we as individual citizens can do so. Talk, if you would, for a few minutes about the response to the threat, John, given what you've said about it, the lack of clarity of its nature, the lack of leadership, and so on. How can we try to mitigate the danger it poses to the rest of us?
That's the million-dollar question, too. And I think this, number one, this has to be handled at the local level. I know a lot of people I've talked to, they're like, but you have to have, you know, the Congress and the president. Yeah, that would be nice. But the bottom line is our Constitution is built that the states run the state, not the federal government doesn't run the state. And it is up to courageous governors and state legislators. As an average citizen, what I would encourage is go to people that you know have the ability to reason and to absorb factual information that might be a town council member or a local sheriff. And I always focus on the sheriffs because the sheriffs are the most powerful law enforcement officer in the country. Get them to understand this, or encourage them to understand this, and go with it. You know, one of the cautions I'll give is a number of people I know who are very well informed on this, citizens, will go in and they'll really kind of beat someone who normally would listen. They'll beat them over the head, like, why aren't you doing something about it? Instead of just saying, hey, can I buy you a cup of coffee, and can I share with you a very significant concern I have? When you approach it that way and give them either my book or some articles or some of the whatever it is, that's what I would encourage. I actually have something at my website that is meant for that, a book, one of the DVDs, and a cover letter for a sheriff or a police chief or a pastor or a business leader.
Give us that website again, John Guandola.
It's understandingthethreat.com. But I believe that it's at the local level that this has to be handled, because as this percolates up, yes, if we get a president and members of Congress who can be bold and actually operate, that would be wonderful. But right now we don't have that. And at the local level, we do have a growing number of sheriffs and police chiefs who are understanding that the feds, the federal, the DHS, the FBI, are absolutely not doing what they should be doing. And once they see that, and they realize that they have a duty to protect their own citizens in their own counties or towns, they will do that.
I think it's fair to say, John Guandola, and I'm sure you have found this too, the folks who are closest to the American people are anxious and committed to their defense once they're clear about the nature of the problem. And what's so insidious about this civilization jihad business of the Muslim Brotherhood, what has been so pernicious in their success in penetrating our government and suborning those like yourself who are not suborning, but trying to silence those like yourself who have an understanding of it and otherwise trying to undo the common sense of the American people as it relates to these sorts of threats, that those further removed from the people, those less accountable from the people, are steering this ship squarely onto the rocks, I fear. If we are to stay off of it, John, it will be in no small measure as a result of your good work, your training programs at understandingthethreat.com, and your new book, Raising a Jihadi Generation, Understanding the Muslim Brotherhood Movement in America. Folks, make this part of your required reading in the new year. By John Guandola, a great guest, a great friend, a great American. God bless you, sir. Have a happy new year. I look forward to talking to you early and often in it, and to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.